Today, we, the Jewish people, have...
More details are emerging about just how deep into the White House last week's intruder was able to get, and troubling weaknesses in the Secret Service's protection of the First Family's home. Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff. Gwen Ifill is away. Also ahead this Monday, thousands of protesters fill the streets of Hong Kong, defying a crackdown by police and demanding more democracy. President Obama acknowledges the U.S. misjudged the threat posed by the Islamic State group and sparks debate over what to do about the militants' rise. Plus, we travel to Kenya for a close-up look at efforts to protect one of the world's most majestic animals from a criminal enterprise determined to destroy it.
The poaching situation of elephants in Africa is actually at crisis levels. At this rate, most of our wild elephants will be gone within 10 years.
Those are some of the stories we're covering on tonight's PBS NewsHour.
Major funding for the PBS NewsHour has been provided by...
Economy for 160 years. BNSF, the engine that connects us.
And by BAE Systems, inspired work. Charles Schwab, proud supporter of the PBS NewsHour.
The William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives.
And with the ongoing support of these institutions.
This program was made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
The president's remarks about the threat posed by the terrorist group known as the Islamic State prompted pushback in Washington today. At the same time, the group's war for dominance in the Middle East threatened to spill over another border. Turkish tanks took up positions along the border today, overlooking the besieged Syrian town of Kobani, where Islamic State forces are battling Kurdish fighters. Stray mortar shells landed inside Turkey as thousands of Syrian Kurds escaped into that country.
We fled from cruelty. The dogs of the Islamic State went into our village and destroyed our farming lands. Now we cross to Turkey. I hope Turkey will accept us. Otherwise, we will seek shelter from the Arabs.
U.S. airstrikes hit Islamic State positions near Kobani over the weekend and again overnight. President Obama offered his explanation for the militants' rapid advance in his 60 Minutes interview on Sunday.
Well, I think our head of the intelligence community, Jim Clapper, has acknowledged that I think they underestimated what had been taking place in Syria.
I mean, he didn't say that, just say that we underestimated ISIL. He said we overestimated the ability and the will of our allies, the Iraqi army, to fight.
That's true. That's absolutely true.
And these are the people that we are now expecting to carry on the fight.
Well, here's what happened in Iraq. When we left, we had left them a democracy that was intact, a military that was well-equipped, and the ability then to chart their own course. And that opportunity was squandered over the course of 5 years or so.
But Republican critics sharply disagreed. On CNN today, Arizona Senator John McCain blamed the president by singling out the failure to get an agreement with Iraq's former prime minister to keep some U.S. troops in Iraq.
We predicted this and watched it. It was like watching a train wreck. and warning every step of the way that this was happening because a residual force would have stabilized the situation and, of course, maybe had a break on Maliki. It is a direct result of our failure to leave a residual force behind.
As for Syria, Foreign Minister Walid al-Mualim addressed the UN General Assembly today and hinted at Assad regime's support for the airstrikes against Islamic State and other militants.
We believe that priority should be given to work on the concerted efforts of the international community to combat the terrorism of ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra and other al-Qaeda affiliates.
The al-Qaeda-backed al-Nusra Front has fought the Syrian government and been at odds with Islamic State since it broke with al-Qaeda last year. But now that both factions are being hit by airstrikes, al-Nusra's leader warned on Sunday of retaliation against Western targets.
Muslims will not stand idly by and watch Muslims be bombed and killed in their countries while you are safe in yours. The price of war will not be paid by your leaders alone. You will pay the biggest price.
Despite such warnings, the White House gave no sign today of easing off the air campaign.
We'll delve deeper into what U.S. intelligence knew and what it should have known about the Islamic State challenge later in the program. Afghanistan inaugurated a new president today for the first time in a decade. Ashraf Ghani will head the new power-sharing government, succeeding Hamid Karzai. Ghani was sworn in at a ceremony in Kabul. He, in turn, swore in presidential rival Abdullah Abdullah as his chief executive. Ghani also made a new appeal for peace.
Fighting is not the solution to the political differences. We proved that political differences can be solved through political negotiations. Therefore, I call upon the oppositions of the government, especially the Taliban and others, to join political talks.
The Inauguration Day ceremony was marred by a suicide attack in Kabul minutes before Ghani was sworn in. It left seven people dead and blew out windows at a checkpoint near the city's airport. Security forces flooded the scene. The Taliban claimed responsibility. New fighting erupted in part of eastern Ukraine today as rebels backed by Russia shelled Ukrainian troops at Donetsk. Officials said 12 people were killed, including seven Ukrainian soldiers, in the worst ceasefire violations in more than a week. Meanwhile, Russia warned that it will retaliate if the European Union or Ukraine pushes ahead with a free trade agreement. The Prime Minister of Israel painted Islamic State and the Palestinian group Hamas today as part of the same threat to humanity. Benjamin Netanyahu spoke to the United Nations General Assembly and criticized leaders who praise attacks on Islamic State fighters but condemn Israel's war on Hamas in Gaza. He called them branches of the same poisonous tree.
As Hamas's charter makes clear, Hamas's immediate goal is to destroy Israel. But Hamas has a broader objective. They also want a caliphate. So when it comes to their ultimate goals, Hamas is ISIS and ISIS is Hamas. And what they share in common, all militant Islamists share in common.
Netanyahu also likened militant Islam to Nazism, and he blasted Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas for accusing Israel of carrying out, quote, a war of genocide in Gaza. California Governor Jerry Brown has signed a law requiring colleges to define when someone consents to sex. The statute is the first in the nation, and it calls for, quote, an affirmative, conscious, and voluntary agreement. It also mandates faculty training in handling complaints, plus student access to counseling and care. Opponents had argued it is not the state's business to define sexual consent. The nation's leading pediatricians group recommended today that sexually active teenage girls use long-acting birth control. The American Academy of Pediatrics called for greater use of IUDs or hormonal implants to reduce pregnancy rates. The group still recommends condoms as well, both for birth control and to prevent sexually transmitted diseases. Bank customers are shelling out more on fees than they were a year ago. The website Bankrate.com reports that charges for using out-of-network ATMs jumped 5% to a record $4.35 per transaction. Average overdraft fees were nearly $33. Banks have raised those fees to make up for federally imposed curbs on other fees. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 42 points to close at 17,071. The Nasdaq fell 6 points to close below 4506. And the S&P 500 slipped 5 to finish under 1978. Still to come on the NewsHour, failures by the Secret Service to protect the White House. How the U.S. misjudged the Islamic State militants. Calls for democracy as thousands of protesters fill Hong Kong streets. Authors take aim at Amazon. Detroit neighborhoods get badly needed facelifts by knocking down dilapidated buildings. And protecting African elephants from poaching. The Secret Service is under scrutiny again for its handling of security of the First Family. The Washington Post reported late today that the recent fence jumper made it farther into the White House than was previously disclosed and even overpowered one Secret Service agent. This on top of a new report that showed a botched handling of a previous attack.
The president does retain confidence in the leadership of the Secret Service and in the men and women of the Secret Service.
The White House found itself defending its defenders again today. Press Secretary Josh Earnest addressed reports of an incident 3 years ago that could have put the First Family in danger.
What's required in an environment like this is a security organization that is adept, that is nimble, and that can be constantly both reviewing and upgrading their posture as necessary. That's difficult work, but the President and First Lady have confidence in the ability of the Secret Service to do it.
The Washington Post reported Saturday that it took 4 days in November 2011 before the Secret Service realized a gunman had shot at and hit the White House 7 times. The president and first lady were away, but daughter Sasha and her grandmother were inside. Reports of shots fired were not linked to the White House itself until a housekeeper spotted broken glass and a chunk of cement knocked loose by a bullet. The shooter, Oscar Ortega Hernandez, who was from Idaho, fled the scene, but was later arrested and sentenced to 25 years in prison.
Everybody out right now. Go back.
The new disclosures came only a few days after an Iraq war veteran jumped a fence, ran across the lawn, and made it inside the executive mansion. Officials have since put up new barriers, keeping tourists and passersby even farther away. We get more from the Washington Post reporter who broke both of these stories, Carol Lennick. Carol, thank you for being with us again. So, new information about this man who jumped the fence last week and got into the White House, and now it turns out farther than anybody thought.
Yes, people have been making jokes today that he went in and made himself a sandwich. It's really disconcerting, but some sources who've come to us and some whistleblowers who have come to Congressman Chaffetz have recounted something more serious about this security breach about 10 days ago. Omar Gonzalez apparently not only made it to the front door and opened it, he made it past the guard who was stationed inside that area and into the East Room. Most, members of the public haven't seen the East Room except on television or on the internet, but it's the ornate, elaborate room that the president uses for addresses and receptions. And this person was tackled there after making it all the way to the south end of that 80-foot-long room. This suggests that he had a lot of opportunities to be close to other people in the House. And as you all know, the president and his daughters had just lifted off in their helicopter at that point from the South Lawn when Omar Gonzalez made a break for it on the North Lawn and got in the House.
So, Carol, this means yet another layer of Secret Service protection was breached.
Yes, and, I'm glad you bring up the layers. So we wrote a story probably about a week ago that was about the 5 security layers that former agents had highlighted for us. And they said, you know, it's just amazing that the successive layers would be breached. First, the counter-surveillance guys on the outside that are supposed to see suspicious activity and jumpers. Then the uniform division officers who are supposed to be able to collar that person. Then the canine dog who's supposed to be released so that that dog can basically act like a missile and knock down an intruder. Then fourth, a SWAT team that's on the grounds able to respond to a crisis. And then fifth, the uniform division officer who's supposed to be posted on the outside at the door at all times. All of those we know failed. However, what we didn't know until today with the account that is spooling out to us was that there was another Secret Service officer posted inside who appeared to be caught unaware that there was an intruder coming her way and about to burst through the door. And when she was caught unaware, though she tried to collar him, according to these sources, he overpowered her and barreled past her and into really the heart of the ceremonial White House.
And this just raises all sorts of new questions. So, Carol, I also want to ask you about the story you broke over the weekend, this incident in 2011. It was known that there was a shooting. The man behind it went to prison for 25 years. What was not known was how much the Secret Service botched this. What exactly went wrong?
You know, I think of this story sort of in three parts. You know, a lot of what went wrong was from an investigative standpoint. So as you have already well described, this shooter pulled out a semi-automatic rifle, pointed it at the White House while he was parked on Constitution Avenue, and struck the residents of the Obamas seven times, two of them going into the windows of a living room that Michelle Obama has described as one of her favorite rooms. Michelle and the president were not at home at this time, but Sasha was at home, their youngest daughter. Mother-in-law Marion Robinson was there, and Malia, their oldest daughter, was on her way home. But what happened was the Secret Service leadership decided that it was very unlikely that this shooter, the gunshots that were heard, were aimed at the White House. They thought that was likely impossible that somebody could shoot that far. And they deduced that instead two gangsters were shooting at each other. They found an abandoned car very soon after the gunfire was heard on the South Lawn, abandoned and crashed. Inside it was this knockoff semi-automatic knockoff AK-47. And again, they deduced this was one of the gangsters' cars. But what they didn't investigate very fully was the evidence of damage that was very clear on the outside of the White House and on the Truman balcony. And also, most importantly, they didn't focus on their own staff on the grounds that night. There is an officer named Carrie Johnson who told FBI agents later that she was underneath the Truman balcony and readied a shotgun when she heard gunfire. She thought an attack was coming over the South Lawn. She heard debris falling over her head from the balcony. You know, these are all those red flags of, wow, maybe something hit the White House. But she, you know, was afraid to counter her bosses who said to her, we've investigated this and concluded.
Right.
It's something else.
Well, two questions very quickly then. What does that say about what's the way the Secret Service is run, number one, and we know it was under a different director then, and number two, has all this been fixed today?
Well, as for the, you know, what are the symptoms, what are these things indicate? Carrie Johnson didn't feel comfortable rebutting her boss's narrative. Officers on the Secret Service and leadership that night, that Friday night, rushed to a hasty conclusion and didn't look very hard and didn't ask very many questions. So it almost seems like, you know, some of the complaints that we've heard over the last several months, that the agency's a little too complacent, that it hasn't had a serious attack or assassination attempt, and thus is sort of starting to get lulled to sleep. That's one thing that a worry that is raised. Second, that it's a top-down leadership culture where, you know, you better toe the line and don't mess with our thought process about what happened here. That certainly looks like it was Carrie Johnson's experience.
Well, it is an extraordinary report, story, and two extraordinary examples of reporting. We thank you very much. And the other part of it we didn't even have time to talk about is the anger on the part of the president and the first lady after this incident in 2011. Again, great reporting, Carol Lenig in the Washington Post.
Thank you, Judy.
The protests, which took over the streets of Hong Kong this weekend and sparked a crackdown by police, continued today in force. Hundreds of thousands were out tonight to protest what they call a curbing of democracy and interference by Beijing in picking local leadership candidates. The Chinese government says the demonstrations are illegal. We have a report from Lucy Watson of Independent Television News.
This is a young generation empowered by unity. Once again here to galvanize pro-democracy thought in a peaceful way. In a city that's fighting to maintain its rights and liberties. Tear gas and pepper spray confronted them last night because their demands pose a threat to their own government and that of mainland China. Alex Chow was arrested for his involvement but believes this is the only way.
You negotiate, you vote, you demonstrate, you ask the government to reform, but you could see all the methods were losing their power. And then you have no way but turn to civil disobedience action.
Britain handed over sovereignty of Hong Kong to China in 1997, with Beijing agreeing to a one-country, two-systems principle. But people now believe that autonomy is being diluted by not being allowed to elect their next head of government through a fully democratic process. There's fear the iron hand of China is tightening its grip.
I hope the Chinese Communist Party won't repeat what they did in 1989, the Tiananmen Square massacre, and make themselves criminals of history.
This family watched and experienced yesterday's violence, but are here again, hopeful. Even their pregnant daughter wanted to return.
I want to let my girl to see nowadays we are here. We are to fight for freedom.
There's a decidedly different atmosphere here this evening with protesters chanting peace, love and unity in the absence of any police presence. And that's because they believe the momentum of this movement is growing as the numbers increase. It's thought around 300,000 people are here tonight.
Proving that generations in Hong Kong are undeterred from their goal. Barriers still grind this capitalist hub to a halt so voices can be heard, in the hope it heralds a future for change.
We pick up now on the president's statements that the intelligence community underestimated the Islamic State group's capabilities and overestimated the Iraqi military's willpower. For that, we get the perspective of Frederick Kagan. He is director of the Critical Threats Project at the American Enterprise Institute. He was a leading advocate for the surge of American forces in Iraq in 2007. And Frederick Kagan, we welcome you back to the program.
Thanks, Judy.
So let's divide this in two, because there are two comments the president made here. Number one, he said that the intelligence community was caught off guard about how fast, how strong ISIS was growing. How do you see that?
Well, I mean, Director Clapper said that they had underestimated the ISIS threat and overestimated the Iraqi security forces. But when you go back and you look at the testimony that General Flynn, the DIA director, gave in February and a number of other testimonies and statements, it's pretty clear that the intelligence community leadership was tracking the rise of ISIS and seeing the threat and seeing the danger. And so I don't think it sounds like the intelligence community really missed this one in a big way.
But hasn't Director Clapper, though, said this in so many words, that they were caught off guard?
Well, he said, yes, he did say it in so many words, but he also went on to give a little bit more context than that. And what he really specified was that they had not been able to estimate accurately the will to fight of both sides. And that, you know, may have helped them not see Mosul fall as rapidly as it did, not see the ISF collapse as rapidly as it did. But that's a very particular issue. What he did not say was that they had fundamentally missed or misjudged the rise of ISIS in general or the threat. And he can't say that, really, and he wouldn't say that because his people have been testifying to it.
And all this is in the context of, we know there's limited intelligence capability inside Syria anyway to know exactly what's going on inside ISIS as it was growing.
Well, right, because we closed our embassy in Damascus. That deprived us of a lot of capability. And, of course, we've had limited intelligence in Iraq also since we pulled out and we did not succeed in negotiating either a follow-on forces agreement or a follow-on intelligence agreement.
And that's the other part of this I want to ask you about, because the president also said that the intelligence community overestimated the ability and the will of the Iraqi army to fight. What is your take on that?
Well, I think that there were a lot of warning signs about weaknesses in the Iraqi security forces that good analysts at the Institute for the Study of War had been tracking in 2013 and laying out. And, you know, there was a lot of desertions. There was a large amnesty that Prime Minister Maliki granted in 2013, which were indicative of morale problems. I'm sure the intelligence community was aware of those. I'm sure that it was aware of the risks. I think what Director Clapper was saying was that, you know, from the standpoint of putting a really fine point on it and saying, well, at this moment, ISIS has the capability to do this and the Iraqi security forces will fold, that they didn't estimate. But I suspect that in terms of generally understanding the state of play, again, I would be very surprised if the intelligence community had really missed that fundamentally.
So when the president went on, and I looked, I was just looking at his interview with Steve Croft at 60 Minutes, he said the U.S. left a democracy in Iraq that was intact. He said a well-equipped military with the ability to chart their own course, but he said it was squandered. And we've heard this argument before from the administration, their belief, their view, and the view of many, that all this was squandered by the former Prime Minister Maliki.
Well, I think the situation that we left behind in 2011 was squandered. I think it was squandered by Maliki, and I think it was squandered by President Obama. I think that the failure to maintain any kind of U.S. military support for the Iraqis was critical. Among other things, it's misleading to say that the Iraqi army was actually properly equipped. It wasn't. It hadn't been designed to stand on its own. It had no air support of its own. It had no ability to police its own airspace. It had a variety of lacks in intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance that everyone had expected that the U.S. would continue to provide. So when we pulled out in 2011, it wasn't just about pulling out our ground forces. It was about withdrawing from the Iraqi security forces enablers that they had thought they would continue to have and leaving them in a bad condition to deal with the fight that they faced.
What about the point, though, Frederick Kagan, that the president went on to say? He said, and he said this before, he said this can't be a U.S. military operation alone. In essence, he was saying it's got to be something the Iraqis want, or how can the U.S. go in and make it happen? And he's pointing out if the Iraqi military isn't going to fight, how can the U.S. go in and do the fighting for them if they don't want it to happen?
I have to say, this is one of the most offensive arguments that has been made about Iraq all along, which is that somehow Iraqis are children and craven and lazy or cowardly, and they don't want to fight. And so unless we really boot them in the rear end and push them forward, then they're just not going to do it for themselves. That's false. Iraqis have fought like lions against al-Qaeda in Iraq. They fought like lions against Shia militias when our troops were there, and they fought like lions for some time after our troops had left. What they need is assistance. They need U.S. assistance, concrete assistance on the ground, and a willingness that we have shown before, but that this president seems not to have, to share the risks with them and share the burdens against a common enemy. Because the biggest problem with this argument that says if the Iraqis don't stand up, then what can we do, is it implies that it doesn't matter to us what the outcome is. But if this group is as much of a threat to us as the president says it is, and I believe that it is, then we have to have a solution to this problem, even if the Iraqis aren't going to stand up and do it. And when he was asked that question, he punted.
Well, when you put it all together, the president is acknowledging the intelligence community made mistakes, but he's saying the philosophical view of the administration was, how could the U.S. continue to conduct this fight if the Iraqis themselves didn't care enough to do it on their own?
Right. And I think the biggest problem here is that the philosophical view of this administration is that they campaigned on end this war. And he campaigned on we're done and we're not going to be involved in Iraq. And for 5 years, while Maliki has been making mistakes and I and many others have been calling attention to them and warning and calling on the administration to press Maliki in various ways, to try to help in various ways. This administration has shown the most profound disinterest in what's going on in Iraq. And I think it's very telling that called to account on this, what the president said was somebody else got it wrong.
We hear you, Frederick Kagan, the American Enterprise Institute. Thank you.
Thanks.
A battle between Amazon and a publisher and some very notable authors is kicking into higher gear this week. Jeffrey Brown has the story.
It's a fight that started last spring over the price of e-books when Amazon demanded discounts from the publisher Hachette. That was rejected, leading to Amazon's refusal to pre-order, discount, or promptly deliver many Hachette titles. The publisher's authors took the fight public, and now they've been joined by hundreds of other writers, including Philip Roth, Salman Rushdie, and Ursula Le Guin. The writers also want the Justice Department to investigate Amazon for illegal monopoly practices. Roxana Robinson is a novelist, biographer, and president of the Authors Guild and one of the leaders of this effort. For the record, Amazon has not responded to several invitations to join us. So, Roxana Robinson, what is this fight about now? Has it become a debate whether Amazon is just too powerful today when it comes to the market for books?
Well, there's several ways to look at it. Yes, Amazon is incredibly powerful. It dominates the market in books of all sorts. And it is the reason that everybody became so vocal about it was the fact that Amazon targeted writers who were completely vulnerable in this circumstance and unable to change the situation. And so Amazon took on the writers for Hachette and made it very difficult to buy their books. So these writers have seen plunges in their sales and plunges in their income, and it's something that they can't do anything about. We find that unacceptable for a huge marketer who got its start selling books to target writers and make them into victims.
Amazon, of course, it is a marketplace. Amazon argues it wants to lower the prices of books. It can sell more books that way. They say publishers don't want this and want to keep the price high for themselves.
Well, here's the thing. Amazon has made a public claim saying that they have studies that show that if you drop the price of e-books, all e-books would sell more. They don't show what those studies are. They don't show any numbers. It doesn't make any sense. First of all, it presumes that there's an infinite demand for books, which isn't true. If you made all the books on Amazon free, they still all wouldn't find homes. So people buy the books they want to buy. Secondly, it won't change people's reading habits. If you want to read Moby Dick, you're not going to buy a romance novel just because it's cheap. You're going to buy Moby Dick. So it's not really going to change things. What they want to do is drop the prices of e-books so they can make more sales, so they make more money. It's not going to help a huge proportion of the people whose books are sold through
Amazon. You know, it is true, of course, that the publishers Hachette included are part of much larger corporations. They're big guys too. So I wonder, for you as an author and authors you work with, do you look at the publishers as the good guys versus the bad guy Amazon? Is there any good guy here?
Well, here's the thing. Of course, Hachette is a huge company. It's a billion dollar international company. It's dwarfed by Amazon, which is much larger. But the big difference is their attitude towards books and towards writers. And what publishers do is invest in books. They pay advances to writers. They recognize the fact that it may take years to write a good book for a biographer, for a writer of history, and they invest in the book. Amazon doesn't do that. Amazon doesn't do editorial tasks. They don't take a position on the intellectual merit of a book. So in terms of supporting our endeavor, our intellectual property, there's a big difference between these two companies.
On the other hand, though, Amazon has created this marketplace in which books are so much cheaper for consumers. They're so much more readily available. Millions of people clearly like that. And authors see a changing industry, right? A changing world of commerce.
Absolutely. And Amazon has by lowering their prices, they have driven out of business a lot of bricks and mortar bookstores. So there are lots of people who have no choice but to buy on Amazon, and Amazon makes it very easy. And we all have to accept the fact that most books are sold on Amazon. But that doesn't mean we have to accept the fact that they are targeting writers and punishing us for something that we have no control over.
Have you or other writers you know been in touch with Amazon? Have they reached out to you at all to find some kind of resolution?
Amazon has been very close-mouthed about this. They have reached out to someone I know, and I was sent a letter asking if writers would support a response that they would make, which became public. It was a deal in which Amazon and Hachette would give money to charity, but writers still wouldn't make any money. But they certainly have not come to any table, as far as I know. I don't know. Both sides are being pretty quiet about this.
And just very briefly, this new effort among hundreds more authors, some very prominent authors, this has become a very public matter. Is that a strategy, I guess, on the part of authors?
Well, it's a circumstance that we find very troubling. And, you know, there are millions and millions of readers in the United States. So we are bringing this to the public.
All right, Roxana Robinson, novelist, president of the Authors Guild. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now, how Detroit is tackling a staggering amount of blight with some unusual help. The city is going through the largest municipal bankruptcy in U.S. history. Earlier today, a judge ruled that Detroit is permitted to shut off water for residents if they don't pay their bills. This comes as the city is under a great deal of pressure to turn around its larger deteriorating situation, including thousands of shuttered buildings. Special correspondent Christy McDonald from Detroit Public Television has our story. As part of the Detroit Journalism Cooperative, funded by a grant from the Knight Foundation and the Renaissance Journalism Project of the Ford Foundation.
A demolition crew at work in northwest Detroit. This one crew will knock down up to 10 houses in a day. Ronald Garrison lives next door to this one, vacant for years. Trespassers looted it of anything of value.
The man down the street boarded it up, and they used to come rip the boards off and still go back in there, and he'd have to come board it up again.
The numbers are in. There are nearly 80,000 dilapidated structures across the city of Detroit. A number so high because of scrappers. Vandals tearing everything of value out of vacant properties, leaving them open to the elements. Once there's structural damage, the houses have to come down.
Oh, yeah.
The scrapping is so rampant, Derek Watts says, even inhabited homes can be targets.
You have to watch your house even if you go on vacation. You can go on vacation and come back and your house be scrapped. So you got to watch it really 24 hours a day, you know. That's the thing now. That's the hustle now.
With the city bankrupt and operating under an emergency manager, Detroit's new mayor, Michael Duggan, is focusing on the demolition of the tens of thousands of houses stripped beyond repair.
And what kind of speed are we seeing, and what are the numbers that we're seeing?
Well, it's pretty remarkable. I mean, the city has historically knocked down maybe 50 houses a week. We're now knocking down 200 to 250 every single week.
Before Duggan, the city's demolition plan had been slowed by bureaucracy. Duggan took office in January. He says his new team has been able to streamline the demolition program. Now residents like Kai Belcher are seeing action.
I came home one day, you know, these two houses were down first. Then my mother and them said they were coming back for the other ones because they had the paper up. So I was, you know, sure that they were going to come back and take care of the rest of them. So it's pretty good.
Last year, the Obama administration and Michigan Governor Rick Snyder helped create the Detroit Blight Task Force. The task force brought together government, foundations, and private groups, some for the first time. Glenda Price co-chaired the task force. She says when everyone started working together, things started to happen.
that you did not see impact because there was no concentrated strategy to go neighborhood by neighborhood where you could actually see a difference.
And you finally have it.
And we finally have it. You can't do one house on the east side, one house in Brightmoor, one house someplace else, and feel as though you've made a difference. You do three houses on one block, and by golly, you have made a difference.
So you have a staggering number of blighted properties. I can only understand that there would be a staggering price tag to go with it, to remove them.
Approximately $1 billion.
The city has some of that money in the bank, but it's nowhere near enough to remove all the blight, which is estimated to take 5 years.
Where does the money come from a city that's going through a bankruptcy process?
That's a really good question. And so the first $50 million came from the federal government in TARP funds. And I got an application in now for another $50 million. And I think if the federal government continues to see the progress we're making, they'll be supportive.
In the fight against blight, technology is key.
Now click Blext Property. Mm-hmm.
Citizens are using a smartphone app that tracks changes in their neighborhoods for better or worse. It's called Blexting, short for blight texting. This is the crowdsourcing of information and comes courtesy of a couple of young Detroit entrepreneurs. Sandra Yu does community outreach for the program.
Loveland Technologies is a tech startup in Detroit and just geeks about property and wanting property to be used for the highest and best use.
Norma Heath is president of the West Euclid Block Club in the Midtown area of the city.
But this is a way that you know how to black, so see who owned the property. You see everything that you need to know.
We want Blexing to be part of what it means to be a citizen. You mow your lawn, you take out the trash, you Blex properties in your neighborhood.
And I hover over here.
Monique Tate of the nonprofit group Data Driven Detroit hosts some of the Blexting boot camps, training residents across the city.
So having this kind of information available leads to exactly what we want, data-driven decisions. So community groups can decide where are we going to focus our efforts and our attention, because they can easily pull up on the public dashboard a map of their specific neighborhood to see where are the vacancies.
What we recommended and what they are attempting to do is look at what we're defining as tipping point neighborhoods. Those neighborhoods where a little investment will stop the decline.
This is the Marygrove neighborhood, one of the Detroit neighborhoods that's at the tipping point. There's lots of streets just like this one, where you've got homes that are well taken care of, but sandwiched in between others that are vacant and run down. The city is now aggressively targeting homeowners, either clean up your property or lose it. And they're also offering incentives for people to buy homes like this one, to move in and to stay here.
Gloria Mitchell moved to Marygrove in 1978.
When people talk about Detroit blight and some of the neighborhoods that are up and down, how would you describe how your neighborhood and your street fits into that?
It fits right in the middle. We have quite a mix here now, where it went from working class, it's now retirees, former working people, it's families, new, old. It's everything here.
This Marygrove home is about to be seized by the Detroit Land Bank Authority. The land bank has been in operation for years with little notice. Now, the mayor has hired more staff, including attorneys, computer techs, and a communications director.
Detroit Land Bank Authority, it's pretty simple, really. We are a place that is a clearinghouse for vacant property in the city of Detroit. Our goal is to either sell it to somebody that wants to live in it, auction it off to get somebody to live in it, and if we don't have any other options, we will demolish the property.
The land bank has started a pilot project called the Forgivable Grants Program. In Marygrove, suburban-based Talmer Bank is putting up seed money for home buyers, money it does not expect to be repaid. Patrick Irvin runs the bank's grant program.
We're going to give $1 million of our money in these grants that are forgivable grants for people who want to live in this neighborhood with their families and be here for a long period of time.
Here, auction winners can receive up to $25,000 to fix up their homes if they promise to live in them for 5 years.
Oh, wow. First try.
In Marygrove, Jay Meeks takes possession of the house he won for just over $8,000.
It's structurally solid on the outside. It's a decent size. I like it.
Meeks is 29, an upwardly mobile PhD student who grew up nearby. He lived on the East Coast, but recently returned home.
I'm excited about the opportunity for great things to come and my ability to contribute to them. So,
if the Marygrove pilot project works, other parts of Detroit might get financial incentives like this one. That is, if the city can recruit more charitable lenders to bring more people back into the neighborhoods.
Finally tonight, the threat to Africa's elephants reaching crisis proportions. The world is taking notice, and this coming weekend, an international march for elephants will be held in cities in the U.S. and around the globe, including in Kenya, where Jeff Brown recently visited and had a close-up look at the situation.
The African elephant. It's the largest land animal on Earth. Weighing up to 7 tons, these behemoths move more gracefully and sometimes faster than seems possible. When you're up close, it can take your breath away. And yet today, they're among the most threatened animals.
There's perhaps no better place in the world to see elephants in the wild than here at Amboseli National Park in Kenya, under the shadow of Mount Kilimanjaro. But there's a massive slaughter of elephants going on throughout Africa now, and there are great fears that scenes like this might be impossible in the not-so-distant future.
The poaching situation of elephants in Africa is actually at crisis levels. We're losing 100,000 elephants in 3 years. At this rate, most of our wild elephants will be gone within 10 years.
Paula Kahumbu of the group Wildlife Direct is referring to scenes like this. Horrific, gruesome, and all too common. Elephants killed for their magnificent ivory tusks. Elephants need their tusks for fighting, feeding, and playing. But to poachers, the tusks mean big money. Despite the 1989 international ban on the trade of African elephant ivory, demand for tusks has grown, especially in China, where ivory carvings have long been prized and new wealth has pushed the price per pound to historic highs. Poachers can make more than a year's salary by killing one elephant. And experts say today they are organized and well-armed, with clear connections to cartels, militias, even terrorist groups.
He's a victim of ivory poaching.
Here's one casualty, orphaned elephants, aged 2 months to 3 years from all over Kenya, given shelter at the David Sheldrick Wildlife Trust in Nairobi National Park. Edward Lusichi has been caring for them for more than a decade.
We see their mood, we see their emotions when they come in.
You do?
Most of them are sad, they're stressed.
How can you tell?
You can tell because they don't want to associate with you or with us. They don't want to feed from us. They don't want to play with us. They're most of the time like looking down, like crying, like mourning.
Yeah.
And you can tell that is a mood of sadness.
It's amazing to walk among them like a group of young children jostling one another and you. Older ones caring for the babies, their trunks and keen sense of smell used to identify a visitor.
Mm-hmm.
Whoa.
In Amboseli National Park, we learned more about the elephant's complex and highly developed family and social lives, and about their communication skills, their ability, for example, to sense danger. Using one of more than 70 different sounds, they can warn friends and family of potential threats or just say hello. Katito Sayalel is Deputy Director of Research at the Amboseli Trust for Elephants.
Elaine.
You look at those marks very carefully.
Okay. Based near the swamplands of the National Park, where elephants eat, drink, and escape the dry, dusty salt plains.
We have 62 family units.
Sayalel says she knows every one of the park's 1,500 elephants.
And we know all of them individually by names.
not just by name, but also by date of birth, family history, and even personality. And the elephants know her so well, they don't mind when she drives her Land Rover into the center of their herd.
He knows her. Yeah, he knows the car.
Knows the car. Mm-hmm.
The sound of her voice, scent of her shirt, all familiar to them. The founder of the trust, Cynthia Moss, sums up the research.
They're very complex, very highly intelligent. They have very large brains, very complex and convoluted brains, and they have a very rich social life.
But Moss adds,
they are smart, but they're not smart enough not to get killed by people with AK-47s. So.
And that's where these men come in. They're among the 300-plus rangers who patrol in and around the park, trained by Big Life, a private foundation dedicated to stopping the poaching of elephants and rhinos. It's a huge area, some 2 million acres, impossible to cover fully. And it's grueling work. Big Life rangers hike through thick, thorny bush, sometimes for days at a time, in search of threats and signs of the animals themselves.
Normally, the wounded elephant can go to the foot of the tree and scrub themselves where the injury is, so you can see the blood.
Oh, I see.
So once you come across with that incident, you have to follow that animal until we get it.
In a dense lava forest home to endangered rhinos hunted for their prized horns, Officer Joseph Makoki explained the dangers and difficulties of catching poachers before they strike.
They've got the binoculars, they've got the GPS, so yeah. They've got everything.
And they can come quickly,
they can
as soon
come
as
quickly.
They know where an elephant or rhino
so
is.
So it'll to be easy for him to come down straight, hit the alley, and go out.
So you have to act really quickly, too.
Yeah, so we have to be always ahead of them.
And Big Life has had an impact, making thousands of arrests in its four-year existence.
That's a huge deterrent.
Co-founder Richard Bonham says they've worked hard to engage the locals, mostly members of the Maasai tribe, including using them as paid informants.
If you can get the community behind you who are living with these animals, if they're behind it, then that's 90% of the battle won. You're not fighting the community. They're fighting for you.
Does the word get out, do you think, or is it getting out?
Oh, it's interesting. The Bush Telegraph works so fast.
The Bush Telegraph?
Yeah. You know, you make an arrest this morning, and by lunchtime, everybody in the whole area knows about it.
Still, it's a small success in a war that Bonham and others fear is being lost.
I think we're containing it. Well, we are containing it here. But when you put that against what's happening across the rest of the continent, you know, the situation's out of control.
Controversially, the agency charged with the task of protecting the elephants, the Kenya Wildlife Service, believes the situation is not that dire. Assistant Director Julius Chepti told us that the government takes this very seriously and is throwing resources into it.
This is a notion that people are saying, that poaching is out of control. From Kenya Wildlife Service point of view, that is not the case.
Activist Paula Kahumbu scoffs at that and says the government is afraid of scaring off tourists.
At the moment, tourists are wondering whether it's safe to come to Kenya, in part because they're seeing photographs of dead elephants. It means there are people running around those protected areas with guns. It doesn't make you feel very secure.
If things are bad here, she and others say, they're even worse elsewhere in the continent, where war and other problems make it impossible to fight poaching. As the sun set on this day, at least, all seemed peaceful for the mighty beast living under Mount Kilimanjaro. The looming question, how much longer will it remain that way?
Again, the major developments of the day. The Washington Post reported the man who jumped the White House fence 10 days ago got much deeper into the mansion than initially disclosed. And U.S. airstrikes again hit Islamic State targets in Iraq and Syria. At the same time, Turkish tanks deployed along the Syrian border, where the militants battled Kurdish fighters for a key town. On the NewsHour online right now, 32 years ago today, three mysterious deaths in the Chicago area sparked a panic over tampered Tylenol that gripped the nation. Read how that episode forever changed the way we consume over-the-counter medications. That's on our health page. And in case you missed it, Saturday was American Graduate Day on PBS. As part of the special broadcast that focused on education, Hari Srinivasan led a conversation about the importance of exposing children to books as infants and toddlers. Here's an excerpt.
Why is early reading so important to a young mind?
Early reading is so important because of how much it really helps develop their brains. Children receive that nurturing by being in their parents' lap. They learn early word and letter recognition. They learn what a book is. They learn that books have a beginning and a middle and an end. They have positive associations with it. So when they start preschool or kindergarten or anything else, and a teacher pulls out a book, they say, oh, it's a book. And they don't do what too many children do, which is to look at that and say, oh, my goodness, what is that?
Right. So if they didn't have that, why is it so hard to catch up?
It's hard to catch up because the first 1,000 to 2,000 days of life are so critically important to children. The brain is much more plastic at that time. They really, all the skills we use in learning really are developed in those first 5 years of life. So we need to do it earlier. We don't have as great an ability to remediate later. We can, but it's just not as effective.
We have a link to the entire American Graduate Day program on our website. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. On Tuesday, an inside look at one of the most expensive medical facilities in the country and the difficult choices families must make in the final days of life. I'm Judy Woodruff. We'll see you online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us here at the PBS NewsHour, thank you and good night.
Major funding for the PBS NewsHour has been provided by...
I've been around long enough to recognize the people who are out there owning it. The ones getting involved and staying engaged. They're not afraid to question the path they're on. Because the one question they never want to ask is, how did I end up here? I started Schwab for those people. People who want to take ownership of their investments like they do in every other aspect of their lives.
BNSF Railway. And by BAE Systems. Inspired work.
And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. Supporting science, technology, and improved economic performance and financial literacy in the 21st century.
And with the ongoing support of these institutions.
This program was made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.